We move to the second lecture of this session. Will be given by Wolfgang Winkelmeier, who is a nephrologist and professor of medicine at the Baylor College of Medicine in Houston, Texas, and also has been involved in many activities related to clinical research throughout his career. He actually adds to the Austrian flavor of this meeting, since he is Austrian and graduated in Austria before he moved to the U.S. And I think he's a great person to give this talk about anticoagulants, since he has published extensively in this area and now participate in some of the important institutions related to clinical research and implementation of clinical practice as a co-chair of the KDIGO and a member of the executive committee of the SONG Initiative. Welcome, Wolfgang.
Thank you. Thank you, Roberto. I think both Peter and I are happy to be here in New Orleans, not in Austria right now, where 4 meters of snow were dumped over the last 10 days. So, Peter, thanks so much for the invitation, and also to your team, and especially accept my gratitude for staging this wonderful meeting every single year, which I think is one of the best meetings that we have in nephrology, and I hope you guys do agree. Vivek gave a wonderful keynote, and it's really a hard act to follow. I'll focus on a much more mundane aspect of kidney health, and that is a very specific clinical problem that has, you know, been very, very difficult to solve with patients recently. That's the question of oral anticoagulation in patients with advanced kidney disease. The title includes the word update, and that is relevant in that I gave a similar talk 5 years ago here, I believe. A lot has happened, or maybe not, and so we'll be talking about that over the next 30 minutes or so. Also, since this is a conference focused on dialysis predominantly, I will actually not be focusing on advanced chronic kidney disease not requiring dialysis. It's possible that some of that will be covered in a talk later today. Here are my updated disclosures. Nothing toxic, I hope. And before I give you an update about oral anticoagulation, let's just cover a few of the basics to bring everybody back up on speed. Atrial fibrillation, of course, is the most common arrhythmia, and it is as common as maybe 10 million Americans today suffer from atrial fibrillation, and it increases over time. Worldwide, you know, 35 million individuals have atrial fibrillation, and the lifetime risks are considerable. I wish I could say that I was still 40 years old, but if I were, I would face a 25% chance of experiencing atrial fibrillation during the remainder of my lifetime, which I thought was a big, big number. Why is atrial fibrillation important? Well, most obviously because of its established relationship to ischemic stroke. Indeed, all types of atrial fibrillation, be it paroxysmal, persistent, or permanent, all predispose to subsequent ischemic strokes. And that also includes what we'd call subclinical atrial fibrillation, which is the atrial fibrillation that neither the patient knows about or senses, nor a physician has diagnosed. And so in combination between, you know, those clinical and subclinical atrial fibrillation types, probably approximately a third of all ischemic strokes can be attributed. But it's not just ischemic stroke that is a problem. Data here from the RELY trial indicate that while 7% of the deaths in this trial were from stroke, a large number of other specific causes of death are also happening in this population, including 22% of the patients died from sudden cardiac death. And us being nephrologists or in the kidney health field in dialysis, this is an outcome that that is very resounding and that we face every single day. Of course, heart failure also very, very common here in this population. Luckily, and that's one of the few, you know, really fantastic stories of modern medicine, maybe I'm exaggerating here, is that we have a very efficacious treatment to fight ischemic stroke in patients with atrial fibrillation. Here, data from a meta-analysis of the early trials that brought vitamin K antagonists to market by Bob Hart, where he very clearly showed that in these efficacy trials compared with placebo, let me see how it works. Here it is. That the risk of ischemic stroke indeed can be reduced by 2/3, and that's one of the largest efficacy numbers of any medical intervention that we know. And so if the evidence is so strong, then you can get great guidelines. And indeed, the American Heart Association and their partners have put out very unequivocal guidelines, and where it says, for example, that for patients without mechanical heart valves at high risk of stroke, chronic oral anticoagulant therapy with a vitamin K antagonist is recommended. And the dose, of course, needs to be tailored to in a certain range of the international normalized ratio. You know, being a co-chair of KDIGO, where our core business is the development of guidelines, I always look at envy, with envy at the guidelines that the cardiovascular field is able to develop, because here we see a level of evidence A, which unfortunately in nephrology we don't see often enough. And here's another statement. Oh, also evidence, level A, anticoagulation with the vitamin K antagonist is recommended for patients with more than one moderate risk factor. And they're listed here, and you may have heard of the CHAD score, and there's a more modern version of it. Essentially, it means that patients who are older, who have hypertension, heart failure, and who have diabetes should be candidates to receive oral anticoagulation. At KDIGO, we hosted a controversies conference just under 2 years ago, and this is just a little, very simple figure, you know, from that conference report that simplified demonstrates why, as nephrologists and kidney health professionals, we should be concerned about atrial fibrillation. And that is that atrial fibrillation predominantly affects patients with kidney disease, and the more advanced the kidney disease, the more atrial fibrillation you will find. And the reason for that is that both atrial fibrillation and kidney disease share a number of risk factors. And some of those may be non-modifiable, such as age, and others are, such as obesity or smoking, physical activity, hypertension, heart failure. In addition, they also share as risk factors some of what we term novel risk factors, if you will, such as inflammation, oxidative stress, or fibrosis. And so jointly, all these factors explain why atrial fibrillation is so common in patients with chronic kidney disease or end-stage renal disease. Indeed, it has been shown very nicely that both domains by which we define chronic kidney disease, that is eGFR and albuminuria, are strong and independent risk factors for the development of incident atrial fibrillation. Further, it has been shown that atrial fibrillation is associated with progression, incidence and progression of chronic kidney disease, and it is particularly common in patients with end-stage renal disease undergoing hemodialysis. We had the privilege to publish a nice, I think, paper at the time that first brought the prevalence of atrial fibrillation, the hemodialysis population, on the map. And we found that 10% of the adult U.S. Hemodialysis population had been diagnosed with atrial fibrillation. And some of the age strata, such as patients over the age of 75, had, for example, a 25% prevalence of atrial fibrillation. Little did we know, relying on a claim that the true number is actually much higher. I'm citing a very nice paper from my hometown, that's Vienna, Austria, where in the greater metropolitan area of Vienna, electrocardiograms are routinely done in dialysis patients. And the group led by Oliver Königsbrügge went to all these units and identified that among the dialysis population, the prevalence of atrial fibrillation was as high as 27%. And if you look even further by using some of these novel technologies, you know, implantable loop recorders, such as we did in the monitoring dialysis study, we found that 41 of hemodialysis patients had at least one atrial fibrillation episode over a follow-up period of half a year, and that episode was more than 6 minutes in duration, which my cardiovascular colleagues tell me indicates a significant atrial fibrillation episode. So atrial fibrillation is indeed a big deal in the population with end-stage renal disease on dialysis. And just to hammer that point home, you know, that ESRD has a number of factors that contribute to this high burden of atrial fibrillation. Here, a very nice schematic by Koren Tsopoulos and colleagues that came out in KI almost a decade ago. And you can see here there's a number of traditional and non-traditional risk factors, including, again, inflammation, oxidative stress, activation of the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system, autonomous nervous system abnormalities. That's, I think, where Peter Kodanko started his investigative career in this area. Very, very much a disturbed system here. Volume and pressure overload, and then certainly last but not least, dialysis-associated factors such as the cyclical electrolyte and volume and hemodynamic changes that are imposed on these patients by the way in which we deliver dialysis. And so all of this explains that there is electrophysiological and structural change happening in these patients, which makes them prone to developing atrial fibrillation. This is a very nice figure, also a side product of the monitoring dialysis cohort, where we were able to relate these atrial fibrillation episodes to the timing of dialysis in these patients. And as you can see very clearly, this is a week depicted here in 12-hour increments, that there are these bars that are sticking out, and these are the bars that initiate on minute one of the hemodialysis treatment, clearly indicating that there's something happening during and immediately following dialysis that happens, or that we do to the patients, if you will, that makes them highly prone to have atrial fibrillation episodes during those times. And that certainly is, first of all, an eye-opener, but secondly also provides potentially an opportunity for intervention and for rethinking how we can change our delivery and prescription of dialysis, for example, to reduce this atrial fibrillation burden. Of course, it's always very important to consider outcomes, and let me just quickly focus on this meta-analysis that was published by Deb Zimmerman, where you can see that mortality in patients on dialysis is approximately twice in patients with atrial fibrillation. The rate here is 26 events per year, per 100 patient years, whereas in patients without atrial fibrillation, it was pretty much exactly half of that, indicating that mortality is doubled in patients with atrial fibrillation compared to otherwise similar patients who do not have atrial fibrillation. And when you look at the risk of stroke, the numbers are similar. The excess risk is a little bit higher, maybe in the ballpark of 2.5 to 3 times higher in a patient with atrial fibrillation. And one aspect that has been understudied was recently revealed in that it also depends on the risk of outcomes depends on the timing relative to when atrial fibrillation first occurred or was first diagnosed. It was quite staggering to see these numbers that over the first 30 days after atrial fibrillation is first diagnosed, the risk of ischemic stroke more than doubles. The risk of a heart attack goes up by 70%. The risk of all-cause mortality is almost tenfold during that time period. And subsequently, it goes down, a little bit over the next 60 days, and then maybe to a baseline, to a nadir, which is still an excess incidence of those events, 50% higher for ischemic stroke, 25% higher for myocardial infarction, and a more than doubling the death that I just showed you, indicating that interventions maybe should be tailored and started very early after first diagnosing this arrhythmia. Now, I hope I've shown you conclusively that atrial fibrillation is common and is consequential in patients with end-stage renal disease on hemodialysis. So, what can we do? Of course, we have this evidence from the general population that oral anticoagulation is highly efficacious, and that when you look at the relative excess risks of bleeding events, which I didn't show you, is still net beneficial. However, as so often, dialysis patients were never trialed with regard to oral anticoagulation, certainly not against placebo. And so we need to make a leap of faith and need to either accept that the evidence from the general population pertains to our patients on dialysis as well, or maybe we are not willing to take that leap of faith, and certainly there are a number of very hard pieces of evidence that suggest that we cannot simply take evidence from the general population. And in this specific case, why might that be the case? Most obviously, we also know that our patients on dialysis have excess bleeding risk. And, there's a number of physiological reasons why that might be the case that are depicted here on this review paper figure. And it all comes down to the fact that in patients on dialysis, there's abnormal platelet function, abnormal platelet adhesion and aggregation, and then also release, reaction, and amplification that together first forms and then consolidates a clot. And all of this leads to increased bleeding risk, bleeding diathesis. And when you look at clinical outcomes, you know, this is a paper that I would term as classic, conducted by Steve Seliger when he was a fellow at the University of Washington, where he compared patients on dialysis from the USRDS with age-matched Medicare beneficiaries from the general population. And Steve was able to demonstrate that the risk of hemorrhagic stroke in patients on dialysis is increased massively by a factor of 4 to 6, dependent on gender and dependent on race. And so clearly there is this excess risk of bleeding. Of course, quite conveniently, let's also point to the ischemic stroke outcome, which is also much increased in this population, in some population strata such as Caucasian women, by a factor of tenfold. There's other bleeding, upper GI bleeding, as nicely shown here by Julia Yang when she was a visiting scholar at Stanford, where she applied different stringent or more lenient definitions of upper non-variceal GI bleeds. And what she found was that the rate of upper GI bleed in the ESRD population is somewhere between maybe 7 and, you know, 33 events per 100 person years, which also is a really large number. And while not directly comparing this to the general population, the authors here concluded that the rate of upper GI bleeding in dialysis patients was at least an order of magnitude higher than in the general population. And then, of course, as, you know, dialysis docs or nurses or others working in the field, we also note that there's the issue of bleeding from vascular access. And while fatal hemorrhages from vascular access bleeds are indeed quite rare, as recently presented in this paper by Jose or Joes et al., in Australia, everybody knows that bleeding from the cannulation site can be a problem. It's unnerving for the patient. It's bothersome, certainly for the staff. And as a physician, you will hear about it, not just from your patient. And so these are certain considerations that need to be taken into account as you decide whether to anticoagulate a patient with atrial fibrillation on dialysis or not. So here's two key questions that, as a community, we need to answer, and that is, what are the relative incidences of ischemic versus hemorrhagic complications across the continuum of CKD, and does the extent of kidney dysfunction alter the benefit-risk relationship of oral anticoagulation? We know it's favorable in the general population, but is that the case as we reach CKD 4, maybe 5, or even 5 on dialysis? This field was famously understudied, and this was stated as such in an annual data report of the USRDS by Chuck Herzog at the time. And so there was an opportunity for the clinical investigative community to look at this. Kevin Chan published a very nice paper using, I think the first time, the entirety of the Fresenius Medical Care electronic health record environment to look at this question, and he identified with his colleagues 1,671 incident hemodialysis patients who had atrial fibrillation at the time of starting dialysis. I think this is a very small number compared to the true number, but that's what they were able to identify. And then he separated these patients into whether they had been or had received at that time warfarin or whether they did not. And what they found was that the risk of stroke was double in patients who used warfarin compared to those who did not. And so, you know, that's kind of an interesting finding. So let's split it up by type of stroke, and he was able to do this. And he found that there is a hazard ratio of 2.2 for hemorrhagic stroke. And, of course, that makes sense because if you anticoagulate somebody, you know, they will bleed. Less face validity can be attested to the second finding, where the risk of ischemic stroke was found to be increased almost twofold by 81% specifically. And so the question then, you know, when you see these findings is, you know, why do we see this? Can we apply the face validity test? I don't think we can. At least it doesn't pass it. And so what went wrong here? And I think one of the main reasons was inherent in the study design, in that two key principles of investigating drug safety were violated here. And the two key principles that you need to implement is using an inception cohort, which means identifying patients at the time when the medical decision making should occur, i.e. when atrial fibrillation first gets diagnosed. And secondly, you want to apply a so-called new user design, where you exclude all patients who previously had had been exposed to the drug of interest, in this case oral anticoagulation. Which may have been, first of all, for a completely other indication. But also, there's a reason why people stay on any preventive drug, and this is a preventive intervention, you know, or why they do not. So you really need to also, you know, find people who start this treatment de novo. And we had the opportunity to apply these principles to a relatively smaller regional cohort of patients in New Jersey, and our findings at the time were strikingly different. You know, we did not find any difference between warfarin initiators and non-initiators with regard to mortality. Of course, we also found the increased risk of hemorrhagic stroke, but the effect estimate for the risk of ischemic stroke was quite different. It was not significantly different between the two groups, as you can see here, with the wide confidence interval spanning from 0.61 to 1.37. But the effect estimate is around 1, and if anything, on the side of the null value where we'd like it to see for preventive intervention. But that was certainly just a preliminary study. Another study, you know, replicated this slightly in Canada, in Ontario, and Quebec. Again, risk of stroke between warfarin users and non-users was no different. Risk of bleeding was increased. And so, you know, with Medicare Part D coming along, starting in 2006, finally, as a community, we have the opportunity to use large-scale data to investigate drug safety in the ESRD population. And Jenny Shen, who is now at Harbor UCLA, did this study, and she used the USRDS and used Medicare Part D claims to identify oral anticoagulation use. At the time, it was only warfarin. You know, applied an inception cohort design, a new user design for warfarin. And so here we're finally playing with a larger cohort. We're playing with, you know, almost 13,000 patients, all of them on hemodialysis, all of them newly diagnosed with atrial fibrillation, meaning that at least a year back looking, there was no AFib claim or code whatsoever. And of those, a very small proportion initiated warfarin. And that's, you know, a common theme if you look at this literature. There's a great deal of, you know, nihilism, or if I may cite my friend Glenn Chertow, renalism, in applying preventive medicines, including this one here. And so 15% indeed filled a prescription for warfarin within 30 days. And then we did some, you know, fancy math and tried to control for everything that may have been different and came up with a table of results. And let's just look at this very busy table very, very quickly. We did two lines of research here. One using what in the trial domain you would call intention to treat. So you carry your first exposure forward indefinitely, whether or not the patient continues the treatment. And then the other one was an as-treated approach, where you censor patients after discontinuation of the treatment of interest, in this case oral anticoagulation. And 60 here means that we actually carried it forward by another 60 days, because you kind of want to attribute outcomes still to the original exposure, in, you know, and you can subject this to sensitivity analyses. And so what we found here, let's start where should we start? Let's start with all-cause mortality. So intention to treat, there was exactly nothing. You know, hazard ratio is 1.01, and owing to the large sample size, we have tight confidence limits, you know, between 0.92 and 1.11. That's an intention to treat. When you look at as treated, which accounts for discontinuation or drop-ins, later initiation of warfarin use, we come to a very different conclusion. We find a 16% reduction of mortality from any cause, and that was, you know, the significant, let's just say, the 95% confidence limit excluded the null value. Let's look at ischemic stroke, which we have down here, and the intention to treat analysis here shows a significant reduction of stroke by 32%, and when, you know, accounting for treatment discontinuations again, the effect estimate is almost unchanged. The confidence limit is now larger and spans the null value, you know, simply because we have less person time to play with and fewer events as a result. But certainly a very, very different finding to where we started out from with Kevin Chan's study. And so this is where we stand. But, you know, what we didn't quite appreciate or understand was how it come that we have such a big difference in mortality, a null finding right smack on the 1.0 and a significant reduction in mortality once we censor patients. And so we tried to better understand, you know, treatment continuation patterns here. And it was an eye-opening exercise. As you can see here, and this is the line that looks at warfarin initiators, this is time to treatment discontinuation. And so if you look at the 12-month mark, it indicates that 70% of patients who initiated warfarin de novo after having been diagnosed with atrial fibrillation are no longer on oral anticoagulation after 1 year. And conversely, on the other side, you know, there were an additional 10% of patients who were new starts beyond the 30-day mark, if you will. What that means is that the majority of person time that we studied here had actually two groups that had a few people on oral anticoagulation and the other one as well. So if you compare groups on both sides that have similar degree of treatment, don't be surprised if you carry the baseline exposure forward that have been null finding. And so that was very impressive to see that in general routine practice in the United States, initiation of oral anticoagulation using warfarin does not get cared for, is not being sustained very long in these patients. There's another important aspect, and that is how well anticoagulation is controlled in these patients, and, you know, something we couldn't study in the USRDS, but that we could study in the Veterans Affairs system. And so Minto Turaki and his group and this is, by the way, the wrong citation here, looked at this in the VA system, and they separated anticoagulation control, meaning what proportion of person time was spent within the INR range that we're trying, that we're desiring to achieve. And patients were separated by type of kidney disease or absence of kidney disease, and so this is eGFR. And over here, excuse me, you find the patients with dialysis. And, you know, what is very clearly visible here is that anticoagulation control, you know, is bad to begin with. You know, welcome to the United States. This is not Sweden or Norway. But it also goes down significantly as kidney function declines. But most concerningly, among patients on dialysis, and almost all of those patients were hemodialysis patients, they actually spent the majority of the time outside the desired INR range, more than 50%. And that makes it very clear that, you know, if you are not in the range that you desire, you will either bleed or you will not derive any benefit with regard to ischemic stroke reduction. And so that certainly highlights a great difficulty and a big problem that is specific probably to oral anticoagulation using vitamin K antagonists. Now let me change gears here and focus just briefly on direct target oral anticoagulants, which, you know, came to the market, you know, almost a decade ago, I guess, in September 2010. Dabigatran was the first one. And, you know, all of them have some degree of renal excretion. But more importantly, once again, patients with end-stage renal disease were not trialed here. They were not included in any of the trials. And so as a result of that, there was no recommendation to include these patients or to treat patients with any of these four available or novel or direct target oral anticoagulants. Here already, with the exception of apixaban, where the FDA was willing to give a dose recommendation in the label based on a single dose exposure in seven patients, which I find remarkable. And since then, another similar label extension has been granted, a dosing recommendation for rivaroxaban. And so clearly, you know, are these drugs being used? It wouldn't be the first time that off-label use occurs. And we did find that they were indeed used very early on over the first 14 months of availability of dabigatran. There were, you know, a couple of hundred patients in the United States treated with this. That fact alone is not remarkable. What is remarkable, in my opinion, are the initiation doses that we found. We found that two-thirds of patients were given the full throttle dose of 150 milligrams twice daily, and then there was another third who received half of that, and there were even some patients who got 75 milligrams, you know, just once daily. And, you know, when you see such treatment heterogeneity, you kind of ask yourself, you know, did they know what they were doing? And the answer is probably no. It was probably that a cardiovascular colleague was not aware or didn't have it on his radar screen or hers, that these are ESRD patients, just did what they would do with every other patient. You know, but there was relatively, you know, swift adoption, even absent any evidence in the hemodialysis population. This was an early slide, again, out of the Fresenius electronic health record system, you know, where, you know, a few hundred patients received rivaroxaban or dabigatran, but then updated this, you know, Kevin Chen updated this a little bit later when apixaban came to market, and also then when, I guess, they received a label extension somewhere here. But what you can clearly see is apixaban was adopted and has been adopted by the, you know, I'm not sure renal community whether I should say that, but at least by colleagues who care for these patients in the cardiovascular setting. And at this point in time, one can safely attest that that more than 10,000 patients in the United States today are on apixaban, hemodialysis patients, that is. Evidence, you know, not so much. And so Kevin did a safety study, comparative safety study, using a new user design, an inception cohort design here. And what he found was quite troubling at the time, in that patients who initiated dabigatran or rivaroxaban had an increased risk of bleeding compared to otherwise similar patients who received vitamin K antagonists. And, you know, absent any trials, you know, we rely on observation data to a certain extent. This is a paper, relatively hot, at least warm off the press, came out at the end of last year out of the Michigan group, where they specifically focused on the comparison between warfarin and apixaban, now the most widely used novel oral anticoagulant in the ESRD population. And what they found was, in this head-to-head comparison, this is apixaban any dose versus warfarin any control level, I guess. What they did find is that with regard to stroke, the desired outcome that we wish to reduce, there was no difference between the two groups. But, you know, again, at least the effect estimate was on the correct side, if you will, of the null value, indicating, you know, potential benefit, at least no signal of harm here. What about bleeding? Indeed, patients on apixaban had a significant lower rate of bleeding, and that would be any major bleeding, any gastrointestinal bleeding, although that crossed the null value, but goes the same direction. Same with intracranial bleeding, not a lot of events, but also going into the right direction. And interestingly, a barely non-significant finding with regard to death, indicating that patients initiated on apixaban compared to otherwise similar patients initiating warfarin may not derive much health benefit with regard to improved outcomes that we try to prevent, but at the very least, they have lower rates of bleeding. That's in itself, I think, an important message. It's relevant to look at the apixaban here with regard to their to the dosing, the pharmacokinetics, because, as I told you, the FDA was willing to extend the label based on a single dose in 7 patients. A fellow at the Brigham and Mass General, Tom Marvakanas, worked with Dave Cheriton and others there to look at repeat dose, steady-state pharmacokinetic parameters, again, just in a small number of patients, N is 5 here. And what they found is that if you use the lower dose, 2.5, you know, you're really at the lower end of the dose level where you want to be, regardless of what metric you're using, the area under the curve or the trough level or whatever else. But when you go to the recommended dose of 5, then actually 2 out of the 5 patients exceeded the 90th percentile of population distribution of level here. And the conclusion from this paper was, you know, maybe let's be careful if we use apixaban, maybe just, you know, the lower dose and not the higher dose. This is not the last word of this, and I cannot speak into greater details. There will be a rebuttal to this conclusion that will be resounding. But I think at this point what we can talk about is this secondary analysis of the Siontis paper from Michigan, where they looked at the comparison between apixaban and warfarin dependent on the apixaban dose. And so we have the 2.5 twice daily dose here in black and the other one in burnt orange, as UT fans would say. And what you can see here is that with regard to bleeding rates, it really didn't matter. It really didn't matter whether you had the larger or the smaller dose. Those were very, very similar associations compared to warfarin. But look at the effectiveness results here. Clearly, those patients receiving the larger dose did receive significant benefits with regard to prevention of stroke, and perhaps, or actually also with regard to death, and those patients who received the 2.5 dose had no different clinical outcomes that we're wishing to prevent here. And I think that's an important lesson, you know, and I'm not recommending anything here, but I'm just stating if somebody were to initiate a patient, you know, you do it fully or not at all, in my opinion. You know, if you want to derive a preventive benefit, then go for a significant dose and, you know, don't do something homeopathic, and that's maybe substantiated by this slide here. You know, luckily and also sadly, there are now two trials underway, and I'm running over, I'm sorry for that, that look at the specific question. Both of them are industry-sponsored, one in the United States, and I'm talking about this just briefly. There's another one in Germany with similar design, and this is the renal AF trial, of which many in the room probably have heard. A comparative safety non-inferiority trial that compares patients on dialysis with atrial fibrillation between warfarin and apixaban, 5 milligrams BID, except they have, you know, either high age or very low body weight, which warrants a reduction in dose. And as you can see here from clinicaltrials.gov, this was from December. If you look at this today, you will find an updated statement here. But we initiated originally or started this wanting to include 800 patients on dialysis and then flipping the coin between warfarin and apixaban. I guess we were supposed to finish this trial and publish it next month. No, not happening. This is a screenshot from yesterday. 155 patients included, and then the sad statement, and that's all I can say owing to confidentiality agreement, but this is in the public domain. Renal AF is no longer recruiting participants for this clinical trial. We were unable to find colleagues who are willing to include patients in this trial, and I experienced it firsthand in my own division, where nephrologists were just not willing to manage INR levels in dialysis patients. And so unfortunately, very unfortunately, you know, we will learn something from this sample size. You know, hopefully it's not going to be as conclusive as what we set out to finding. But, you know, what a chance wasted. You know, we don't get to do too many randomized controlled trials in this ESRD population. A similar fate, I hear, from Christoph Wanner, who was here for the KDIGO diabetes guideline meeting earlier this week, happens in Germany. They will also not be able to go beyond, you know, they wanted to do 220 patients, I believe. I think they are shutting this down with less than 40 patients enrolled. And then there's a very ambitious trial, is planned in France by Thierry Andouche in Strasbourg, where they're actually trying to flip the coin between placebo and oral anticoagulation. And, you know, I don't want to place any bets, but I'll be very curious to see how that trial will enroll. So, on this slightly somber note, let me conclude that real-life effectiveness and safety in patients with reduced kidney function, including those on hemodialysis, needs to be determined. This is a situation where the time in therapeutic range with oral anticoagulation using warfarin is very low, where adherence is bad, and certainly we need to do this ideally in the trial setting. Absent trial setting, let's do our very best with observational methods to get at this information. But let's not give up, and let's try to design trials, to maybe do better trials and find the funding so that we can, you know, improve and fill this very, very blatant evidence gap in our dialysis care. What do the latest guidelines say? Let me not, go away without stating this. These guidelines are 5 years old. They have not been updated. In the dialysis setting, the American Heart Association feels it's reasonable to prescribe warfarin for oral anticoagulation. Look at the evidence level, not a lot of evidence here. For direct target oral anticoagulants, however, the evidence level is 3, no benefit, evidence level C, and so it's not currently recommended to put patients on dialysis on a novel oral anticoagulant. And while KDIGO doesn't have any guidelines on this matter and won't have any time soon, the participants of the controversies conference came to a similar conclusion. They do not recommend using novel oral anticoagulants in the hemodialysis population. So I'll leave you with these thoughts. And again, my apologies for going over time, and I look forward to discussing these aspects with you later.